For a reason I'll explain in a minute or two, I'm afraid to stand too close to the podium. Before introducing our speaker, I have one or two matters I would like to mention. One is, of course, the question of membership. These are free lectures, but there are expenses involved. The membership is $30 for families, $20 for individuals, and $10 for students. And if any of you who are not members can see your way clear to make that investment, it is tax deductible and it does help. I would like also to mention another matter. As some of you know, the Institute has been giving these lectures since 1916. It's a remarkable history. There is a book written by Dr. Nemetz, who is the heart and soul of the Institute for these past few years, and of course before that, his mother Belle was very much the person who filled that role. So he is imbued with it. The book has a history of the Institute. It's an interesting read. It's not lengthy. It's concise. And the other aspect of it is that it sets out lectures given over the last several years, a selection of the lectures. It can be had for a $60 donation to the Institute, and there is a box which can be marked off on your, you can, if you don't have a program, you can get one at the table outside, and so that is something I would urge you to consider. One other practical matter I thought I would mention is that of parking. For those of you who aren't within walking distance, and there are some of us, it is there is parking available in this handsome parking plaza that's about 200 feet, I think that would be, to the west. On Saturday nights, at least one gate will be left open, and there is no charge. Sometimes it's a little tricky getting out. Don't try to get out through any gate except one that's open, because you won't be able to open it unless you have a pass. And one evening I had a whole lineup of people behind me and none of us knew how to get out. But apart from those difficulties, it is very convenient, particularly on those evenings when it rains, and there are some such evenings. The last thing I was going to do before introducing our speaker was explain why I'm afraid to get too close to the podium. In my brief career in this job, this is my fifth appearance, I have established a pattern of fouling things up for the speaker. And so I'm apologizing in advance to our speaker should I find a way to do it tonight. But you'll notice I haven't put anything on the podium. When Darrell Duke was our speaker, I picked up my papers and at the same time picked up his speaking notes. And that caused some trouble. On another evening, introducing Professor Winston, I introduced him as Professor Finley, who had given the first lecture. Last week, I thought I'd got along all right with Mr. Nick Gowing of the BBC, a very polished performer who wasn't easily ruffled, and I didn't discern any difficulty at all. But he did attack me gently after it was over and said, "You know, you had your damn papers on top of my mouse and you were moving the mouse around and I was really very concerned." Now, I don't know why the assault on the mouse concerned him so much, but apparently it did. Well, it's my great pleasure, without putting anything on the podium, to introduce to you Dr. Virginia Vallum. born in Detroit, grew up in the Midwest in St. Louis, and has been associated with a good many universities in her career. Took her undergraduate at the University of Michigan, graduating in 1963. A master's in psychology at Northeastern University in Boston in 1968, and then a period as a visiting graduate student at the Rockefeller University in New York. Then back to Northeastern University for her doctorate degree in 1971. Did research at MIT in human language behavior. Spent a considerable period at the City University of New York doing teaching and research to 1979. Was a research associate at Columbia University from 79 to 83, and from 87 to the present has been a professor of psychology at Hunter College in New York. A person of great distinction in her field, and her topic tonight will be the advancement of women, why so slow? And I now call upon our speaker, Professor Elena.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be a part of this long-standing distinguished series. And as far as I can tell, everything's fine here. So far. Why do so few women occupy positions of power and prestige? In my talk tonight, I'll concentrate on the reasons behind women's slow advancement in the professions and in academia, and at the end, I'll discuss some remedies to speed up that advancement. But I want to give you first a flavor, an idea of the data that need to be explained. So I want to give you some data that demonstrate that indeed women's advancement in the professions is slow, that indeed there is a problem. One thing I will do is give you data from a number of different fields in order to demonstrate that the phenomena that we want to explain are general phenomena. They're not isolated to a particular field. That's important to know because it allows us to integrate new data as they come along and to build an overall picture. So we don't need to say, well, who knows what things are like in general, even though in law in Canada, men make partner in large law firms before women do, because maybe that's an isolated case. What I want to do is show you that there aren't isolated cases, there's a general phenomenon. So I'll start with an example of salaries in international business in the United States. These data come from a survey that was conducted in 1991 of United States professionals who worked in internationally related occupations. The males and the females in the study were similar on most dimensions that the investigators looked at. The investigators were interested in understanding what factors contributed to a person's salary. So what factors would be likely to increase how much money someone made if they were in an international an internationally oriented type of business. So they looked at things like the kind of degree that people had, how many years of experience they had, and so on. The factors that helped men make money also typically helped women, but of the 17 factors that were examined, 14 of them helped men more than they helped women. Women's achievements and qualifications appear to be worth less than men's. To take one of the more striking examples, a bachelor's degree contributed more than $28,000 to a man's salary, but only $9,000 to a woman's salary. In some cases, factors that added to men's salaries actually subtracted from women's salaries. For example, having lived outside the United States added more than $9,000 to a man's salary, but subtracted more than $7,000 from a woman's salary. Similarly, having deliberately chosen international work added to a man's salary but subtracted from a woman's. Speaking another language added to a man's salary but subtracted from a woman's. Later on, I'll get to the reasons that I think are behind these differences. This study is typical of others in the literature. Women tend to benefit less from their qualifications than men do. Even when men and women start out on an equal footing in a field, which is more and more the case across the board, they quickly become unequal. Salaries in law and promotion in law provide another example. In the U.S., and I'm afraid that most of my data are from the U.S., young men and women in major law firms currently appear to be making equal entry salaries. And that's an improvement over the past, when even junior people just starting out did not make the same amount of money as a function of sex. But that equality in salary does not appear to last for more than a few years. What we see in law is what we see over and over again in every profession now. Men and women are starting out on an equal footing, but as time goes on, they diverge. Men are getting promoted at a faster rate, they're making partner or getting tenure at a faster rate, and they're making more money than women are. In the back, if you can't hear me, could you give a little high sign? Okay, thanks. But as I told Peter Nemetz, I was a cheerleader in high school, and I could actually give this lecture without any microphone at all. Women are less likely to make partner in major law firms than men are, as studies in both the United States and Canada show. The rates of difference differ depending on the study. In some studies, women are half as likely to make partner as men are. In other studies, the Canadian study looking at lawyers in Toronto, men were 13% more likely than women to make partner. In academia, also in the U.S., men and women now start out on an equal salary footing, both in the humanities and in science. But as early as 5 years post-PhD in the humanities and as early as 2 years post-PhD in the sciences, there start to be salary discrepancies, with men making more money than women. There's certainly been progress. There's been progress in the number of women getting PhDs, progress in the number of women in entry-level positions, and progress in equalizing salary at the beginning of a career. But there's been very little progress in promotion and tenure. In the United States, for example, over a 20-year period, there's been no reduction in the tenure gap between males and females, and that lack of reduction can't be explained by increasing percentages of women in junior positions. What about people who demonstrate early merit? The kinds of data that I've told you about so far might hold for groups of men and women as a whole, but wouldn't hold once we looked specifically at people who had distinguished themselves early in their careers. A study by Sonnert and Holton looked at a group of men and women who had received prestigious national postdoctoral fellowships in the United States between 1952 and 1986, and they were surveyed in the late 80s on a number of dimensions, including their rank. They found that women were less successful at moving through the ranks than men were. 10 to 12 years post-PhD, men were one full rank ahead of women in the sciences, and they were three-quarters of a rank ahead of women in the social sciences. For women, but not for men, there was another problem. There was an inverse relationship between rank and institutional prestige. For women, the more prestigious the institution they were at, the lower their rank. For men, there was no relation. This, too, is something that we see over and over again. Men are represented at high prestige institutions, elite institutions, to a greater degree than women are. And women in those elite institutions tend to suffer with respect to their rank. For example, a recent American Council of Education study of college presidents in 1995 showed that women were only 6% of the presidents at private universities that grant the PhD, which is the most elite group of schools, but they were 25% of presidents of private two-year colleges, a very low prestige group of schools. Recent data about the awarding of science postdoctoral fellowships in Sweden suggests that it's harder for women than for men to achieve these signs of early merit, such as the women in the previous study had done. This is a study some of you may be aware of. It received a lot of publicity. It was written by two women who had applied to the Swedish Medical Research Council for a postdoctoral fellowship in 1995 and had been refused. That particular year, 46% of the applicants were women, but only 20% of the people who got the fellowship were women. These two women, Wennerås and Wold, thought that they had very high qualifications and that they should have gotten one of these fellowships. So they sued under Sweden's Freedom of Information Act to get access to the records of the senior scientists who had been making the judgments about who was going to get a fellowship and who wasn't. And they chose to look at the particular year that they had been denied a fellowship. So this is in the don't get mad, get even category. What they found when they looked at the data of the panelists was that the male applicants received uniformly higher ratings of scientific competence than the female applicants had received. And obviously, the higher your rating of scientific competence, the more likely it was that you would get a fellowship. They then created a model to try to predict what objective characteristics contributed to getting a high scientific competence rating. So what went into the judges' decisions? They found that for men, a model that they called total impact points, which was a combination of how productive the young scholar had been and the prestige of the journals in which they had published, predicted the scientific competence rating very well. There was a nice linear curve. Women, however, had to achieve 100 impact points in order to get the same competence rating as men got with 40 impact points. So women had to be 2.5 times as good in order to make the same impression on the judges as a man. And again, a little later on, I'm going to explain this disquieting fact along with the others that I've been telling you about, but I want to give you a few more disquieting facts before I do that. I want to move on to medicine and look at income data for U.S. physicians in 1990. These are young physicians, where young means under the age of 45, with 2 to 5 years of experience. The income data per hour for these physicians, once a number of factors were controlled for, was equal. So men and women were making the same amount of money per hour. Once you controlled for things like that men tend to specialize in more remunerative specialties than women do, men in the U.S. tend to practice in settings that are more remunerative than women do. This was progress because exactly the same study carried out 5 years earlier had failed to show income equality between males and females. So there is definitely improvement happening. At the same time, when they looked at slightly older physicians, physicians who had 5 to 8 years worth of experience, even when they controlled for all the factors that I've told you about and others, men still made more money than women. So it suggests, again, that things are okay at the beginning, at least in ways that we can measure, but they become not okay around 5 years out, again, to the extent that we can measure. Promotion of women physicians who are in academic medicine also demonstrate that women are not promoted at the same rate that men are. And they also, and here's now a hint of what's going wrong, they also do not report the same access to resources very early in their career that men report. So men physicians in academic medicine report more protected research time, more laboratory space, more office space than women physicians report at the beginning of their career. And all of those resources are, of course, important for later productivity in one's field. We don't know whether women ask for those resources and don't get them, or whether women just don't ask for them. And I'll return to that point as well. 2 weeks ago, a very important study appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the first study of its kind that I know of. What it does is track individual people. So we're very seldom in a position to look at people longitudinally and see what's happening to them in their careers. But Nonemaker had data from the American Association of Medical Colleges that allowed her to get data on males and females who had graduated from medical schools in a series of years, and then to look at whether young women and men who were first appointed to be assistant professors became associate professors, the next level, at the same time, and whether, as associate professors, they became full professors in the same period of time. As I said, I know of no other data that actually track people in this way. And what she found was that across every subdiscipline, and true for medicine as a whole, there were fewer women being promoted to each level than you would expect on the basis of their numbers. Now, of course, the study doesn't control for how good performers these people may have been, but we do want to know, just for starters, well, how many would we predict would be in a given position, all other things being equal? And this study is the first one to be able to tell us we'd predict more than we see. Let me sum up the facts across the professions. Broadly speaking, women's abilities, accomplishments, and contributions appear to be worth less than men's, even when they have the same credentials or if differences in credentials are controlled for. That's the first problem. The second problem goes deeper and concerns the criteria that are being used to evaluate people. To take one example, men in academia publish much more than women in academia do, and this is a worldwide finding. Men's quantity is higher than women's quantity, and quantity is a major determinant of things like promotion and tenure. But if we look at quality as measured by how many times a given article is cited by the rest of the academic community, women's quality is higher than men's. Now, of course, citation count is an imperfect measure of quality, but quantity is an imperfect measure of quality also. Men and women appear to make different trade-offs. Men seem to go for quantity over quality. Women seem to go for quality over quantity. But review panels tend to be taking quantity into account rather than quality. And across the professions, there are many contributions that women are making, which, because they have not traditionally been counted as achievements, continue not to be counted as achievements, and are in part responsible for women not doing as well as men. Before I get to the causes of women's slow advancement, I want to spend a paragraph on exceptions. As I've been talking, no doubt you've been able to think about women who are exceptions. So you can think of your next-door neighbor who is a managing director of the biggest law firm in Vancouver, and you can think of all these other women who are very distinguished. And because we do tend to make those kinds of reasoning errors, you will be tempted to think that there isn't a problem having to do with women, because you can think of successful women. But it's important to realize that an exception is just that, an exception to the rule, an atypical event. The fact that there are a few successful women should not distract us from the main body of evidence, which shows that overall, women are not as successful as men, even when they have the same credentials. Now I want to turn to the causes of women's slow advancement. I want to explain why women's credentials appear to be worth less than men's. My explanation uses two key concepts, the notion of gender schemas, which I'll explain, and the notion of the accumulation of advantage, which I'll also explain. Schemas are like stereotypes, but I prefer the word schema because it's more neutral and I think more appropriate in representing this cognitive activity that we all engage in and have to engage in order to make sense of our world. We must construct hypotheses about how the world works in order to get around. We can't treat every new event or every new person we meet as a wild thing that we've never seen before. We need to integrate it into frameworks that we've already developed. So schemas are the outcome of normal cognitive processes. Gender schemas are schemas about being male or being female. Hypotheses that we all share, male and female alike, whether we want to or not. So we may consciously disavow some of these slightly stereotypic beliefs, but a variety of experiments demonstrate that we all have them and that they are activated very quickly when we get an appropriate person to activate them. We think of males as capable of independent action, as oriented to whatever task needs to be done at the moment, and as doing things for a reason. We think of females as nurturant, expressive, and behaving communally. In brief, men act, women feel, and express their feelings. The main answer that I offer to the question of why there aren't more women at the top is that our gender schemas, our beliefs about these psychological differences between men and women, skew our perceptions and evaluations of others, causing us to overrate men and underrate women. I'll give you an example of an experiment done with U.S. undergraduates an experiment in which students were asked to estimate the height of other students. They were shown photographs of students who were always photographed next to a reference point of some sort, so next to a table, a chair, a doorway, a tree, so that the people who were looking at the photographs could have an idea of how tall the person was in feet and inches. Unbeknownst to the students who were doing the evaluations, the photographs had been chosen so that for every man of a given height, there was a woman of the same height. So this was a sample that diverged from the population and contradicted, in this case, our accurate gender schemas about height. So we all know men are, on average, taller than women. What happens if you get a group of men and women who contradict the schema? Can you accurately perceive how tall those people are? The answer is no. You tend to overestimate how tall the men are and to underestimate how tall the women are. And men and women observers do that to exactly the same degree. So we are both likely, both men and women are likely, to have these gender schemas activated and put them to use when we're doing evaluations. Height, of course, is a relatively benign characteristic to be judging. What's important about this example is there is a characteristic that really is objective, unlike most of the other ways that we judge men and women in professional life. So we like to think that we're being objective, but even those of us who have the utmost confidence in our abilities will agree that professional excellence is not quite in the same category as height. We would expect that gender schemas will play a particularly large role when the evidence is open to interpretation and when our schemas say something about gender differences, as they do in the case of professional competence. So let's think about how we can apply this to some of the examples that I gave you before. If we now return to the study on people in international business, we can make sense out of some of those data. You recall that men's credentials appeared to be worth more than women's, and that in particular, things like having lived abroad, speaking another language, having deliberately chosen to spend time abroad, and to work in internationally related occupations, added to a man's salary, but subtracted from a woman's salary. Why would that be? That would be because the gender schemas for men would see a man as choosing to be abroad or learn a language not for the intrinsic pleasures of doing that, but because getting those qualifications would do something for him down the line. On the other hand, we perceive a woman as doing those same things, not because of the material advantages that will accrue to her if she does them, but because wouldn't it be great to spend a year in France? So exactly the same qualifications we interpret very differently depending on whether a man has them or a woman has them. When men go abroad, their choice signals career commitment. When women go abroad, their choice signals indifference to a career. And employers, without intending to, without meaning to discriminate at all, carry those non-conscious interpretations of people's qualifications and use them when they're trying to decide how valuable an employee will be. Schemas also operate in making judgments of scientific competence. You remember the study of the Swedish Medical Research Council. Here, too, the judges did not intend to discriminate, but their schemas represent women as less scientifically qualified than men. Those schemas affected how the judges viewed information that, again, they probably considered to be objective, but was in fact ambiguous and open to interpretation. (Clears throat) So what I've told you about so far is how gender schemas cause us to overrate men and to underrate women. Let's now consider what happens when a woman manages to get into a position of some leadership. How are people likely to respond to her? Again, an experiment with U.S. undergraduates. This time, again, people viewing slides of people seated around a table. So we have a slide that shows one person at the head of the table and two people along each side of the table. And they're described as being a working group. The student is asked to say, who's the leader of this working group? When all the people seated around the table are females, people say whoever is seated at the head of the table is the leader. When all the people seated around the table are males, the people say whoever's seated at the head of the table is the leader. When it's a mixed-sex group and the person seated at the head is a man, people say the person at the head of the table is the leader. When it's a mixed-sex group and the person seated at the head of a table is a woman, half the time people say she's the leader. The other half of the time, they designate a man sitting along either side as the leader. Again, people are not intending to discriminate. They may, in fact, simply be going by what they take the base rate of leaders to be. Most leaders are men. But it hurts a woman who wants to be a leader because she's hoping she's going to be getting the automatic marks of deference that being in a leadership position usually entail, and she's not getting them. So a woman is less likely to benefit automatically from the marks of leadership that men are benefiting from. Again, in this experiment, there's no difference between male and female leaders. They both make the same judgments about who's likely to be the leader of the group. The examples that I've talked about are small things. One might be tempted to dismiss concern about such imbalances as making a mountain out of a molehill. But mountains are molehills, piled one on top of the other. And that's where the notion of the accumulation of advantage comes in. Very small imbalances add up over time to create significant disadvantages for women. Success is largely the accumulation of advantage, parlaying small gains into bigger ones. A computer simulation demonstrates beautifully the importance of very small amounts of bias. I'll condense my description of this simulation. What the simulators did was imagine an 8-level hierarchy of typical pyramidal shape that you see in organizations with many fewer people at the top than at the bottom. They staffed this fictitious simulated organization equally with males and females at each of the 8 levels. So we start off with perfect equality between males and females. They then institute a promotion process for getting somebody from one level to the next that has in it a tiny amount of bias against women, a bias that accounts for only 1% of the variability in determining who will be promoted. So this is an amount of bias that any organization would be delighted to say was the amount of bias that they had. They ran through the program over and over and over again until they had completely restaffed the simulated organization. And that tiny 1% of accounting for the variance bias resulted in a top that was now 65% male and 35% female. And this actually somewhat underestimates the problem, because this is a bias that's occurring only at the moment of promotion. But in fact, organizational life involves constant evaluations of people. So we can now understand this fact that men and women are starting out equal but are diverging as time goes on. Those very small molehills of disadvantage over time become a mountain. So now let's consider that fact I told you about before, that women physicians start out with fewer research resources than men physicians. We can see now how something that would not even be visible at the time of first appointment, so people would look as if they were equal, men and women were coming in with equal salaries, but these very small differences in things like research resources are over time adding up to create a significant advantage for men. So to sum up so far, what's responsible for women's lack of progress in the professions and in academia is the gender schemas through which we all, male and female alike, perceive and evaluate women. The small but systematic undervaluation of women culminates in women's smaller salaries compared to men and slower rates of promotion compared to men. So far, I've talked about how gender schemas affect our perceptions of other people. What about how they affect our perceptions of ourselves? How, in particular, do gender schemas affect women's perception of themselves? In order to succeed, it's important to be able to negotiate effectively. And in order to negotiate effectively, one must have a feeling of at least moderate entitlement. But women tend to be low in entitlement compared to men. There are a number of laboratory demonstrations of this. You call males and females into the laboratory, you give them some task to do, and you say to them, I'm going to pay you $10 to do this, and you decide how long you should work until you've done $10 worth. Women work much longer than men do in order to get that $10. They also make fewer mistakes, and per unit time, they complete more work than men do. You can do the experiment the other way around as well. You can give somebody a set task to do, and then at the end, you can ask them, how much money do you think you should get for this? Men always think they should get more money than women think they should get. So women start out having a lower feeling of entitlement than men do. This is also revealed in real life. There's an example from tennis in the early 90s where Monica Seles argued for equal prize money for men and women in tennis tournaments. Steffi Graf said, "We make enough. We don't need more." And Mary Jo Fernandez was quoted as saying, "I'm happy with what we have. I don't think we should be greedy." So women interpret equality as greed. And in 95, Seles, Graf, and other top female players wrote a letter to the Australian Open protesting their decision to substantially increase the size of the men's purse for 1996. So that the men's purse was going to be $390,000 more than the women's. American $390,000 more. But while the players protested, they also pledged not to boycott the tournament for the good of the game. Naturally, the Australian Open organizers saw no reason to equalize the prize money, and the women played for less. This is in sharp contrast to Billie Jean King's efforts in 1970 to equalize the prize money for the U.S. Open, which I believe remains the only major tournament of the Grand Slam that has equal prize money purses for males and females. And she said she would lead a boycott of the U.S. Open, and so they gave in. One way that gender schemas affect women, then, is in their perception of themselves as worth less and entitled to less. Women also, through the chores that they are given to do in childhood, become accustomed to acting for others' good, to laboring for love. As adults, women find it difficult to take themselves seriously as professionals who are entitled to a good salary and to promotion. Others do not take them seriously or have lower expectations for them. That in turn makes it difficult for them to take themselves seriously, difficult for them to negotiate successfully for space, resources, and money. We can also use gender schemas and their consequences to explain something about why women don't help each other more than they do. One thing women know is that women are an undervalued group. So an ambitious woman with high aspirations is hardly going to want to affiliate herself with a group that is not highly valued. That will only result in her own devaluation. Women also seem to have lower feelings of efficacy than men do. Again, a rationally based expectation. If your credentials are counting for less than a male peer's credentials are, it will be hard for you to feel that you are an effective, efficacious, powerful person. So women may not even perceive what they could do to help other women. Finally, both men and women subscribe to a belief in a just world. There are a lot of interesting social psychology experiments on this. Despite all the evidence that people have to the contrary, it is important to them to believe that the deserving are rewarded and that the rewarded are deserving. And it is difficult for them to appreciate the extent to which that is at best an approximate story of how the world works. So the combination of these various factors makes it difficult for women to help women. For women to see themselves as exceptional, even if they are. So in the study I told you about of male and female U.S. scientists who had obtained prestigious postdoctoral fellowships, the women were much less likely than the men to perceive themselves as having above average scientific ability. 52% of the women, compared to 70% of the men, rated themselves as having above average scientific ability. Given what we know, however, given the kinds of data that I've told you about so far, probably the women were on average of somewhat higher scientific ability than the men, because we know you have to be of somewhat higher average ability in order to get the same prizes that a man gets. So not only do gender schemas result in lower evaluations of women than men, but they also result in a lower sense of entitlement and efficacy in women than men, and some unwillingness on the part of women to help other women. Now we turn to the optimistic part of the talk, the what is to be done part. How can we take care of this problem? The advantage of a problem that's as intricate and multifaceted as the one that I've described is that there are lots of things one can do from a small level to a large level. Today, I'm going to concentrate on steps that institutions can take to improve the role of women. First, institutions can try to develop valid and objective criteria for evaluating people's performance. So we know that women are likely to do somewhat better if the criteria are objective criteria. And so using, for example, total impact points rather than scientific competence as a rating. But it's not good enough just to have them be objective. We also need to have some idea of whether or not those criteria are valid. And institutional change tends to be very slow, so it's difficult to say, let's have some different criteria here by which we're going to evaluate people, because those criteria have been used over and over again by the people who are running the institution. So one thing that institutions need to do is to examine more closely what kinds of contributions that are valuable to the institution people are making that are not getting officially recognized and rewarded. Second, institutions need to communicate the criteria for advancement equally and explicitly to both men and women. A number of the things I've said so far demonstrate that women are less likely to feel entitled to promotion. That will be exacerbated if women do not even know what the criteria for promotion are. Men tend to get information about criteria for promotion through many informal channels that women in institutions are not privy to. An important remedy that institutions can put into place is to make sure that everyone is getting access to information about what is required for advancement and information about what resources the institution has available. A nice example of this comes from the MIT study that you may have read about last spring, where the dean of the School of Science and the president of MIT acknowledged that women were not getting access to the same resources and were not getting paid the same amount as men in the school were. One example that they mentioned was the fact that MIT has internal money available to give to people who are between grants, because you don't want to let a lab just die. So people could apply internally to get this money while they were still applying for external money to keep their labs going. Women did not know that this fund existed. No one intended to keep this information from them, but it was also the case that no one was making sure that everyone had access to the information. And this is an example of how institutions can be creating unequal practices without anyone in the institution even knowing that those unequal practices exist. So it could be the case that no one in an institution knows that there's a problem in a particular area, as no one knew in this area until by chance they found this out. So all 15 of these senior full professors who were women at MIT did not know about this internal money. Okay. Institutions can also develop intervention programs, as did the Johns Hopkins University Department of Medicine within the School of Medicine. They approach the problem extremely systematically and in a very common sense way, and over a period of 5 years, managed to quadruple the number of women at the middle level of associate professor. In their investigation of what was going on in their department, they found out that senior men were not suggesting that women were appropriate for promotion. They also found that women themselves did not know what the criteria for promotion were. They found that the senior men mentored young male faculty much more effectively than they mentored young female faculty. For example, the senior male faculty arranged for young men to chair sessions at conferences at 6 times the rate that they suggested that for young women. Again, there was no intention on anyone's part to discriminate or to give one group a head start over another. Nevertheless, it was happening. So they instituted 2 different programs, one in which they had workshops to tell women about how things worked, another in which they told mentors how to mentor. So what things mentors had to look out for so that they would treat the young male and female faculty whom they were mentoring equally. Another thing that institutions can do is to train evaluators to correct errors in evaluation procedures. We know something about how to make people better evaluators. We know what conditions are likely to promote fair and impartial evaluations and what conditions are not. We know if people are held accountable for their decisions that they tend to make better decisions. We know that if people have enough time to make a decision and are not distracted by having to make other decisions, that they tend to make better decisions. We also know something about what kinds of reasoning errors people are prone to, completely independent of gender, that then get exacerbated in the case of gender. And I'd like to give you one example of this. This was an experiment about four fictitious students who had passed a welding course, and welding was chosen because it was a very highly masculine connotated course, and four students who had failed the course. Many of the facts that people were given about these students were irrelevant. But one fact, namely the students' course load, was determinant. Students who had a heavy course load failed the welding course. Students who had a light course load passed the welding course. There were two different groups of evaluators. One group of evaluators was also told that all the people who failed the course were female, and all the people who passed the course were male. In the other group of evaluators, they were told half the people who passed were male, and half the people who passed were female, and the same for the people who failed. So the difference in the conditions here, in both cases, course load predicted whether or not people would pass or fail. But one group also got this information that was consistent with gender schemas in which the men passed and the women failed. So the question they asked was, would both groups of evaluators be able to detect this information about course load? And the answer was no. The people who got the information that was consistent with gender schemas never perceived that those women who failed had a heavier course load. But the people for whom the gender information was 50-50 did perceive that fact. This is very important for women and men in professional settings because it means when we see a woman fail at a task that we expect her to fail at because she's a woman, we will be unlikely to search for and find the perhaps genuine reasons that she failed, namely she had a high course load or she was given way too much work to do in order to do that job well. In fact, the search for other causes may look to people like a search for excuses. Oh, you're just making allowances for her because she's a woman. So my proposal here is we can teach evaluators and people in positions of authority a lot about the kinds of reasoning mistakes that they are likely to make, and we can teach them how to become better reasoners. Okay, the final thing that I will mention, and then we can go on to questions, has to do with what leaders at institutions can do, both male and female leaders, in order to legitimate aspiring female leaders as much as aspiring male leaders. Again, we know something about how legitimation works, and we can use it to make sure that males and females benefit equally. I'll give you a real-life example of this, story that one woman told me about her department chair who asked her junior male colleague to give a talk about the area that they both worked on to the Board of Trustees, and asked her to give a talk on that topic to the local grammar school. So again, he was not intending consciously to benefit her junior male colleague more than he was intending to benefit her, but it's obviously going to do someone's career a lot more good to present it to the Board of Trustees than to present it to the local grammar school. So leaders of institutions can do a lot to put women and men equally forward as potential leaders of that organization. We know that people are affected by leaders saying that somebody else is a leader. An experiment that demonstrates that is a videotape shown to observers, undergraduates again, and one person in this videotape has been designated as the student leader of a group that's having a discussion. In one version of the tape, a faculty member vouches for the student's expertise, says, "This student was chosen as the leader because he or she," was done with both male and female student leaders, "he or she knows a lot about this subject and has performed very well in the course so far." In the other version of the tape, all the faculty member said was, "Susan or Bill is going to be the leader of this group." And then people watched the tape and were asked to make a number of judgments about this exact same leader. How competent were they? How likely was it that they would be chosen as a leader again? How much money should they make? And so on. All of those judgments were more favorable in the version where the faculty member had vouched for the student's expertise, where the faculty member had legitimated the student leader as a leader. Interestingly, the students, of course, knew what the difference, students who got the legitimating information said yes, they had gotten it, but they said it had no influence on their judgments whatsoever. And in this respect, students are very much like us. We all like to think that our judgments are completely independent. We are not swayed by what anybody else thinks. We make up our own mind. But experiment after experiment demonstrates that, in fact, we are very affected by what authority figures think. So authority figures in institutions can do a great deal to promote the role of women in those institutions. In conclusion, on balance, there is some reason for optimism. Although women's advancement is still too slow, although gender schemas operate covertly and bias evaluations, although those small examples of bias add up to disadvantage women, although people's reasoning is prone to particular types of errors, we can understand how these processes work, and we can do something about them. Thank you.
Now, questions.
Okay, before you, I wanted to repeat that question because I don't think everyone heard it. Okay, so this question was about the MIT study and in today's, which paper?
National Post.
In today's National Post, there's an article in which three other U.S. women are quoted as saying that this was a very poor study, it represents junk science, and also the fact that this MIT report has never been publicly circulated. All right, so that's not really quite a question yet. It's a comment, but let's go on to number two.
Number two is that you never mentioned the fact that women bear children, and they take, many of them, or most of the ones who do, take maternity leave, which interferes with their careers and their work progress and so on. Have you taken that into account in any of the fact that, they make slower progress?
Okay, good. The second question is, women bear children. Bearing children has consequences with respect to things like maternity leave, and is that something that's been taken into account in any of the figures that I presented? Okay, so number one first. The MIT study was an internal study, which was never intended for public release, in part because confidentiality would have been compromised. It would have been possible to isolate the identities of some people. So it was always intended to be an internal study. It was not a study of the same magnitude that many other universities have undertaken to determine whether there was equity in recruitment, retention, promotion, and so on. It was a more informal study than that. The reason that that study got so much publicity is that MIT is an 800-pound gorilla and no other institution in the United States is. So there is some justice to the concern on the part of people who are reading what's available on the web because it's very lacking in detail. However, the data of the sort that I presented from other kinds of studies, which we do have full information on, I think make clear that this is a pervasive problem through the professions and academia. Second point, I do never talk about the fact that women bear children. In the studies that I referred to, we are looking at full-time women who either statistically or in other ways have been chosen to be on a par with the men with whom they are being compared. So it's certainly the case, for example, in law firms, most of the part-time people are women who have children. However, when you restrict yourself to full-time women who are putting in the same number of billable hours as full-time men, you still see that women are not advancing at the same rate that men are. So even when you take that out of the equation, women's contributions and accomplishments are still not being recognized to the same degree that men's are. Now, I take your larger point to be that men should take much more of a role in bringing up children, and I agree with that completely. Right. It's a scandal. I agree with you. Oh, yes. Okay. The question was about the awarding of Nobel Prizes, and that the Nobel Prize is the highest award that a scientist can get, and what about the very unequal distribution of male and female scientists who are Nobel Prize winners? One could also, at a lower level, talk about the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, where the percentage of women in every field is much lower than the percentage of men. So what I would invite you to do is to extrapolate from the data on the Swedish Medical Research Council and the information about the accumulation of advantage to what you would predict would be the case about the eventual high prizes of high distinction and high awards. Given the undervaluation of women and given the accumulation of advantage, we would expect what we find, which is a much smaller proportion of women, even with respect to their numbers, than you would expect. So obviously there are some people who are going to say women are not as good scientists as men are in the fields that they practice, but I think I've given you enough information so that there's another interpretation that you could put on that. Okay, the response is, isn't the Nobel Prize awarded on the basis of the uniqueness of the contribution rather than on something like quantity of publication? The Nobel Prize, like all prizes, is a political decision. The awarding of the Nobel Prize is a political decision. Any given year, there were five other people who could have gotten it who didn't get it in a particular field. And the sociology, work that's been done on the sociology of the awarding of prestigious prizes, makes clear that this is the Nobel Prize is yet another arena where our belief in a just world is misplaced, that there are a lot of factors that contribute to this award. So this is not to say that the people who have it don't deserve it. It's only to say that there's a lot of other people who deserve it who don't have it, and women are probably among that number.
Ma'am, the blue.
I'm not sure what direction your question is headed in. Let me repeat it for the room as a whole. A question about public education in the elementary years or secondary years, that young women are being given certain advantages or at least are more efforts that are being made for them to continue and do well, and they are doing better, and boys are dropping out. And I'm invited to comment on this perhaps fact. Okay, so I can't comment on the facts because I don't know what the facts are. I'll take the facts as you've given them. And what I would say is we do need to spend time with boys so that they do not expect that simply in virtue of being male that they will have certain advantages. So we need to educate both boys and girls so that they will see the benefits of equality, and neither group need more in order to do well. Okay. So two questions. The first is, what institutions have been particularly good in promoting gender equity? And the second is really a question about what kinds of motivations can one give institutions so that they will be interested in gender equity? This is a problem that I'm now getting very interested in. With respect to the first question, non-elite institutions do a better job of equity, and public institutions do a better job of equity. Companies which deal with a diverse population, that is, have a diverse customer base, do a better job of equity. So the institutions that are hardest to change are the most elite institutions, because they're doing extremely well as it is, and they don't see that they need to change anything. And indeed, they fear if they do change something that things will get worse. So I think an important contribution to be made with respect to public policy is, in fact, to delineate reasons that institutions will want to change, ways that they can see they will do better if they do change. A lot of these reasons are abstract and therefore somewhat hard for institutions to appreciate. One example is, if you've got somebody there, you've hired somebody, you should try to be making sure that you spread the resources equally among the people whom you've got there. So it makes no sense, given that you've hired women, whether they're 10%, 25%, 40% of the people that you've hired, doesn't make sense to systematically give them fewer resources. That's just a waste of the employment efforts that you went through to begin with. But as I said, that's a somewhat abstract argument that can be hard for people in an institution to completely grasp. But it's probably an argument that highly elite institutions are somewhat more sensitive to, since they are in the business of creating stars and Nobel Prize winners and so on. So they can see some motivation there. Another suggestion, which appeared in a recent article by a UBC social psychologist, Mark Schaller, has to do with innovations within institutions. So there's evidence that the more diverse the group of people that you have in an institution, the more likely it is that a valued innovation will have some place to take root. Because one problem institutions have is the cloning problem, having dozens of people like themselves and therefore missing out on new things. So there's evidence that having a diverse workforce means there will be people there who will be responsive to innovations that will help the institution as a whole. So I don't have by any means a complete answer, but I think it's a very important direction for us to go in, and that there is some useful work that tells us what direction to go in. Okay, the question is, why do women in professional settings look like men? to caricature it somewhat. There are costs to women, both of being perceived as feminine and to being perceived as masculine. So we know from a variety of experiments by Madeline Heilman and her colleagues that women who appear feminine, and there are many things that can highlight a woman's femininity, from being the only woman or one of just a few number of women to being very attractive, are things that compromise her being seen as competent. So the more feminine she appears to be, the less competent she will appear to be. Because for both sexes, attractiveness highlights, intensifies how good a representative you are of your gender. So an attractive woman is really a woman, and an attractive man is really a man. So being attractive for a man is a real plus in a professional setting. But being attractive for a woman is, at least with respect to judgments of competence, a minus. On the other hand, if a woman is too masculine, she also pays a price. And there are data on that as well. So it's probable that I got many more frowns from the audience tonight than a man presenting the same material would have gotten. So there are videotape studies that look at young men and young women being assertive in a friendly way, which is how I hope I did appear to you tonight. And the women who adopt that friendly, assertive leadership style get more negative than positive facial reactions, whereas the men who adopt that same style get more positive than negative facial reactions. So a woman has to tread this very narrow line, if she's willing and interested in doing so, to appear neither very feminine nor very masculine in terms of how the people around her will respond to her. Now, for some women, this may be a choice that they do not want to make. They want to be themselves. But if being yourself is either being very feminine or being very masculine, there's a cost to that. So women who work in professional settings may indeed adopt a way of dressing that's designed to erase perceptions of them, especially as a sexual object, but even as a woman.
Ma'am?
Okay, so the question is, of course, partly a question of fact, which I can't answer since I don't know the fact, but there's apparently a perception that young women at UBC are getting much more than their fair share of scholarships, and the question is that a fact or is that just a perception? I can only answer by analogy. So if... let's assume for the moment that it's not a fact. Why would people perceive it as a fact? I think some of the material that I presented earlier would suggest why it would be perceived as a fact, because we don't see women as competent as we see men, and so women who are getting prestigious fellowships, scholarships, or whatever, are extremely salient and likely to be overrepresented mentally than they actually are. It may also, well, let me stop there. So I think it's more likely to be the case that it's assuming that it's 50-50, that it's due to our perception of women as not very competent to begin with. There are some data about how long men and women talk. And women are perceived as talking a lot. But when you actually measure how long men and women talk, men are very big talkers. But we perceive women as going on, because women shouldn't be holding the floor to begin with. So we've got a pretty narrow idea of how much space women should be taking up physically, verbally, in every way. So if a woman goes beyond that amount of space, it seems like it's a whole lot, even though it isn't. I don't think I understand the question. Could you...
Yeah, I'm looking at men sort of smooths together, the belong to the clubs versus women are sort of left out. They study by themselves and sit the men are going up perhaps playing tennis, dealing in business matters. Again, women are being left out.
Right. Certainly women are being left out, and women who try to get in are not necessarily being welcomed to get in. So these informal lines of communication are things that are particularly difficult for women to deal with. One example of this is a woman who told me about being the first female chair in her school. So until she became chair of her department, there had been no women chairs. And about 3 months into her tenure as chair, she realized that she was always getting the information behind all the guys. And she couldn't figure out how this was happening. And finally, she asked one of the men whom she had a very friendly relationship with, why is it that you all seem to know what's going on, what the dean said, and so on, and I don't find out about it for a week or so. And he thought for a moment, and then he said, it's probably our nude swim on Friday afternoons. So for years, the male chairs had been having this nude swim in the university pool on Friday afternoons. And even when she became chair, they continued having the nude swim. And whatever information one of them had gotten from the dean, the others then got from the dean. And she was just out of that loop. And there was nothing that she could do about it.
Now, in fairness to our speaker, I think I'll cut it off after two more questions. The lady in red up. Yes.
Okay, so the question is, in 20 years' time, will the roles be reversed? And I take it was mostly men who thought that this was the case. Most women would
close the doors
to the men. Okay.
We'll have to wait and see.
The grain of truth in that is that women and men are much more alike than they're different. So that's one thing that we know about men and women. Although I've been talking a lot about sex differences tonight, it's important to keep that in perspective. Our human commonalities are much, much greater than these sex differences. However, I think that that 20-year estimate is very much of an overly optimistic projection, and that certainly if we look at things like tenure gaps and what women have to do in order to be perceived as equal to men whom they have more credentials than, it's very unlikely that that's going to happen. We need to take a much more active role in understanding how gender schemas work and how the accumulation of advantage works in order to make any kind of difference. I'm happy to take more questions.
Are you?
Yeah.
All right. Up at the corner.
I think that that's a good strategy. That is, I think it's important for women to present themselves as professional. The question was, should women in interview situations, for example, if they're going into an internationally related occupation and know another language, indicate in the interview that they learned that other language in order to do that occupation rather than in order to read cookbooks, say. And my answer is a qualified yes. It's always a good idea to present yourself professionally, but it's also important that we train interviewers so that they understand when they are likely to make incorrect attributions about people's qualifications and the importance of having those qualifications. So we don't want to have a model in which we put everything on an individual woman's shoulders for how she should behave. We also want to understand how the system is improperly skewed.
First, behind the bar.
One thing I would tell a woman is to try... Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, what sort of advice would one give a young woman, for example, a young woman in academia, about where she should go in order to be able to do her best work? How could she maximize her professional goals? One piece of information I would provide is that women are better off in institutions that have a number of women in them already. Not because women are nicer to other women, as I've tried to indicate in my talk, is not necessarily the case, but because she is likely to be perceived less in gender terms in an institution that has a number of women in it. So that institution will not be marking gender imbalances to the same degree. On the other hand, she has to pit that against the resources that the most elite institutions will provide her with, and those elite institutions are likely to have a very small percentage of women, especially a very small percentage of women in leadership positions. So there's a trade-off that she will make. Every woman should read my book. I think this woman has had her hand up for some time.
All right. Get you next.
I've observed in clergy that there are more women now being educated than men in all Protestant traditions. Certainly that's not the case in Roman Catholic.
Okay, are women stepping forward in the educational process in other fields than the ones that I mentioned, for example, in the clergy? To the best of my knowledge, yes, they are. For example, in Reform Judaism and in the Anglican Church in particular. But I don't know of any data on this, so I only know what women in the